Today I want to try to do something that may take a little bit of close attention to some details. We're talking about the process of abstracting. You remember this diagram. We have talked about some of the implications of the fact that this is a unified kind of a process, a bodily process that is all of a piece. It functions as a unified thing, and any divisions of it, any attempt to separate out parts of it is, while you can do it, it involves certain hazards and problems. And some of the problems we have are due to our tendency to do our abstracting as though we could divide the verbal levels off from the nonverbal levels. I want to develop some more today what is involved in the process of abstracting. And over on the far board, there is a diagram which is designed to point up some of the basic questions we have to ask about the abstracting process and the communicating process that is dependent upon it. With that diagram, which I will talk about, we can ask questions like this. What do we talk about? What do we talk about when we talk about anything? What do we talk about? What determines what we say? Think of the box, the diagram, as representing your body, or you as a person, but this is a much more mystical word, you will recognize. But think of that as representing your body, or you as a person, and there is an input over on the left and an output on the right, and there are some filters inside the box, inside you. The input is a sensory input, as we ordinarily would call it, and the output is a verbal output. We'll call it a verbal output. It might be a musical output. It might be an oil painting or a pattern of gestures, but let's call it a verbal output. Now, what is the verbal output about? What do we talk about? There are probably two main extreme points of view, shall we say. The one is that we always talk about the sensory input, that it is what determines what we say. This is another way of saying we talk about the world out there. We talk about the sources of sensory stimulation. We talk about reality, we say. We talk about, that is, something other than ourselves. We have various kinds of names for it, or statements that we make about it. The other point of view is that no, the sensory input is not very important in determining what we say. That we don't, to any very high degree, talk about the world outside our skins. That what we talk about is primarily ourselves. We talk about what's inside that box. Well, let's talk a minute about what is inside the box. I represented it by some lines which I call filters. We talked the other day a little bit about this. The mood filters and doctrinal filters and the language filters. Now, I want to remind you of all this in order to say some other things now. You remember what we said, that two persons, one has had bad news and one has had good news and a letter from home. They see the same football game. And they make two different verbal reports about it because in part they are talking about their moods. Something going on inside them. Or the one is a Baptist, the other one is a Buddhist, and they will make two different reports of something they've seen because of the doctrinal filter which affects the verbal output. And the language that we use, that we learn, of course, is something which is interposed between whatever you mean by the sensory input and the verbal output. The language organizes, at least, what we say. It probably also does much more than that. Now, this leads to some rather basic questions about abstracting. We say that we abstract from the world outside, from reality, from whatever might be. You see, what we try to represent by this lowest part of the diagram. What might be? We abstract from that. What we say, we can see, we observe. In general, these we can call the what levels of abstracting. This is a level of what we ordinarily call facts. These are the facts that are observable facts. But on this level, we also have facts, but they're of a different kind. We don't see them. They're not observable by definition. These are not observable facts, but they're facts. They're inferential facts. We infer from all that we do see that there must be something that would account for what we see. And what we infer, such as electrons or genes or brownies, we call facts too, but they're a different kind of facts. This is, we might call this lowest level then, the why level of abstracting. It is on this level, it is with regard to this level that we seem to be referring, it is to this level that we seem to be referring when we ask why. Why do birds fly? Birds fly is the first order fact. You can call these first order fact. I think it's a very good term in its effects. First order fact. Birds fly is a first order fact. Trees have bark. First order fact. When a fly bites you, you itch. First order fact. That is the way people do. That is the way birds do. In the book, I refer to a nice little children's story about a yellow duck. And it's all, the little yellow duck is always diving around, doing the things ducks do. And the line occurs over and over again in the book. That is the way ducks do. First order facts. This is a very useful kind of a notion. It, I think, is one of the most important things you can know about when you come to the very hazardous and in some ways joyous experience of raising children. The average 3-year-old asks 400 questions a day. And a lot of these can be answered by saying, that is the way ducks do. That is a first order fact. And it's the most, I think, honest answer you can make. The answer that would be the least likely to confuse and handicap the child later. Why do birds fly? That is the way birds do. That is a first order fact. Now, if you want to go beyond that, be careful. Because here's what you're talking about. And know what you're talking about. Because he may have to just unlearn it all as soon as you get out of sight. In the book, I try to deal with the question, what is a fact? Incidentally, you should now be reading or have read chapters 5 to 10 of People in Quandaries. If you haven't, you will be handicapped, or if you have, I should rather put it, it will be helpful to you to use a more positive language, which I would prefer to use. In fact, I hope you took a little seriously my remarks the other day about reading, and I hope you have read the whole book by now and have not dawdled over it. If you have read it all by now, then you can better read chapters 5 to 10 now while we're talking about them. Otherwise, if you haven't read the rest of the book, there is something you won't know about as you read chapters 5 to 10 now while we're talking about them. So ideally, you will have read the whole book by now, and now you are going back to reread chapters 5 to 10 while we talk about them. I hope you do that, not because that is the best way to make a good grade in the course, this is obvious, but I'm not really that too interested in that. Oh, I'll be happy with you if you do, but because you'll be happy, but that really isn't what is important. If the course has any value for you in your moment-to-moment and your day-to-day life, well, it will have more value for you of that kind if you do what I've just indicated, if you prepare yourself for the lectures. So I hope you do. But not for my sake. Please don't. I'm not urging you to do this for dear old Dad at all, but just for dear you. So as I said, I've tried to deal with the question in chapter 5, I think it is, which is a rather basic question. What is a fact? Most of us, I imagine, value facts. We think that we should stick to the facts. You should know all the facts before you make up your mind. Well, if you really mean all the facts, of course, you'll never make up your mind. But what is a fact? What are you talking about? And I give four answers. I want to remind you of them so we can talk some more about them. A fact, or the set of facts, is necessarily incomplete. I say necessarily because there's a limit to what you can observe. I'll talk some more about that in a minute with the diagram in the middle. Your eye can respond to only a very small part of the total light spectrum. So even if you have all of your sensory marbles, you still get a very incomplete picture of whatever you mean by what's out there. So that it's necessarily incomplete. But beyond that, beyond the limitation imposed by the structure of your eye, your ear, etc. There is a limitation imposed by the position from which you look, your perspective. And moreover, number two, a fact changes, or the facts change. You're observing a cloud of smoke, in a sense. You're observing a process, something that is constantly changing. You've never seen in your life anything that never changed. A fact is personal. You observe it. That is, your facts are your observations or your inferences, if they are the inferential level kind of fact. But because they are yours, and because you are not like any other person in the world, exactly, your facts tend to be different from those of anyone else. But facts form the basis for what we call communication. And so if we are going to achieve anything like effective communication, we must agree as much as we can about what we call the facts. And so facts, it's part of the definition of a fact, that it is the usefulness of it depends upon the degree to which others agree with you about a fact or about your facts. And we, in the book, I developed these ideas. I don't want to read the book to you, but I want to bring into focus this very, very basic question: what do you mean by a fact? What are we talking about? Now, let's use this middle diagram to talk about this a little more. This is designed to represent, in the final chapter of your book, and this is one of the reasons why. The best way to read a textbook is to read it all in the first 2 weeks, because there will be things in the final parts of it that will affect the way you will understand things in the middle of it and so forth. In the final chapter, you'll find a crude diagram from which this is a development, the one in the middle. It's a diagram of the process of one person talking to another, communication process. Or it's a process of one person talking to himself, which, of course, is always the case, but you often have eavesdroppers, but you're always your most important listener, or your most affected listener, or your most enchanted listener, although you may be talking to others. The fateful consideration is that you hear what you say. And as I like to say, I'm going to get much more out of this lecture than you are, because I'm paying more attention to it. You are more affected by your own words. So this can be a diagram of you talking to yourself or of you talking to your roommate. Now, it turns out that the communication process, at least as I would analyze it, can be described as a series of energy transformations. A series of energy transformations. Presumably it begins at the far left end here. And I forgot to put in something meant to represent an energy field. Presumably a person whom we will end up calling the speaker after a while observes something. He sees or hears or smells or hefts or somehow there's an interaction between him and the environment. Presumably, we talk about something. At any rate, the most important part of the study of language behavior has to do with the relation of language to something else, to what it is about, presumably. Presumably, it is about something we call reality, or the world out there, or the environment, or whatever there is in the universe to talk about. And so, for purposes of this diagram, let's say that we begin with the source of energy that can affect the eye or ear, taste bud, or some other sensory receptor. And then at the first stage, then, we'll call this number one, this is two, three, four, this is one time. At the first stage, then, there's this energy field. Now, this somehow interacts with the eye, we'll say. And the eye can respond to only part of the energy field, as we've just noted. It can respond to only a very small part of the total light spectrum. And then most of us don't have entirely normal vision. I take off these extra neural aids I've got. I don't see so well. Oh, what a difference. Well, so I can't emphasize enough that the person who thinks he knows it all is so utterly deluded. There is so little that you can know directly about the world around you, or about yourself as a part of the world around you, which your eyes can see and your ears can hear, and that you can feel. And then there's an energy transformation. At the point of impact of the external energy on the optic nerve, we'll say, there's an energy transformation. Now, the new form of energy is that of the nervous impulse. Wholly different kind of energy form. And this nervous impulse travels into stage number three, the nervous system, into the spinal cord in the brain, where there is already something going on. And so the resulting state of affairs or condition at stage three inside the nervous system is a joint product of what was already going on there and the newly arriving impulses. Now, people differ greatly at this point. There's some who are not much affected by the incoming impulses. If we want to be complimentary about them, we say that they are very stable. I think conservative has become a favorable word in the last few years. Or if you don't want to be complimentary about them, you can say that they're very rigid. Or very, very unperceptive, unresponsive. Depends on your purpose in making the statement. But anyway, basically the fact that we're reacting to is the individual's degree of responsiveness. How much is he affected by the incoming impulses as a result of his observations? Is he affected much by what he sees? Of course, there are some people who can go around the world and stay in Iowa City. And there are other very responsive souls who can stay in Iowa City and go around the world. Be that as it may, the fateful fact we're dealing with here is there's another energy transformation now at the point between 3 and 4. And in 4, something goes on that we call symbolization. The symbolization of what? What do we symbolize? In other words, what do we transform into words? Or tunes in the head, or pictures, or whatnot? The world out there? You talk about reality? You talk about the primary energy source off to the left of that diagram? Well, of course not. It would be an impossibility. Except as you filter it, and what's that word, it? Except as you filter it, that means such of it as you can take in. Except as you filter it through your nervous tissues. This comes very near to being a literal use of the word filter. But another way to say the same thing is that what you symbolize is yourself. It's that, it's what's going on at stage three that you symbolize. It's the silent goings on inside your nervous system that somehow is transformed into words. So in this basic sense, you always talk about yourself. You are always talking about yourself. On the subject of, for instance, Cuba. But you're never talking about Cuba in any disembodied sense. And when you think you are, this can become very dangerous. I remember visiting, I think I tell about it in the book, I don't remember. But anyway, I remember the observation as a very, very important one for its implications. I was in one of the mental hospitals observing, I should add. And I went to the occupational therapy department, and some patients there were painting, doing oil paintings. And one lady was doing a painting that was not so big, about the size of that thing on the wall, all blue, various shades of blue, but all blue. And I asked her what the painting was about, and she said, "That's the war." And I said, "Well, what about the war?" "Well, it's the war." And I tried to find out what she was trying to say with the blue paint. And finally she got a little bit exercised and worked up, and she tended to use her arms and feet to tell me, "That's the war. It's the war." That's all I could get out of her. That's the kind of language behavior that you see in many people who think they're talking about Cuba. That's Cuba. There's no argument about it, you see. Apparently they don't know they're talking about stage number 3. They think they're talking about stage number 1. Now this is one of the very fundamental forms of pathology. Pathological forms of abstracting is that kind of confusion about what you're talking about. There's almost no other question more important for you at any time than the question, what are you talking about? any time you hear a voice sound what you would call excessively positive, I think you should begin to wonder about the implications. You know, I have a hobby, which I demonstrate here every time I talk to you, tape recording. I've been tape recording almost everything I have done for 10 or 12 years. I got started doing this in a research project many years ago, and the effects were so interesting that I have continued it. I think if you wanted to improve American education, the thing that you could do that would have the most effect would be to put a tape recorder in front of every teacher in the country. You wouldn't have to tell her what to do with it. Just, you'd want to be sure that she listened a little, at least. And what do you think you would do if you listened to yourself tape recorded? What do you think you would be most likely to change about your language behavior? Well, I think it's a good bet that what you would be most likely to change would be the tone. This would be what would displease you most as you got more and more aware of what you were hearing. It may be that the first time you heard it, you would be pleased by what you heard because, after all, it's your voice and that's nice. But after you've listened to 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 recordings of what you are saying, when you're talking seriously to a class like this, to a group, or in a conversation, or in a clinical situation, as I often am, I think you would begin to cringe a little at the tone. And you would develop a tone as you went along that would be a little more of a kind that people could respond to. The tone of the paranoid is a tone to which there is no answer. The tone of the dogmatist of any kind is a tone to which there is no answer. And this is the tone of a person who thinks he's talking about Cuba, who thinks he's talking about number one instead of number three. If he knows he's talking about number three, his tone tends to become one that invites response, as though to ask, what do you think? How do you see it? This is what I find to talk about inside me. What do you find to talk about inside you? How have you filtered this? And the tone reflects it. This is a questioning, interactive tone. And you get a very sensitive ear for this kind of tone after you have spent enough time listening to tape recordings and then to people talking, or having, as it were, got your ear tuned. I hope I've emphasized this enough. I just think I hesitate to use words like the key or the secret or so on, but it is a terribly important factor, it seems to me, in the effect it has upon the thinking, the behavior, the verbal responses, whatever you want to call it, and what all you want to include, of a person's behavior. Now let's say something about number four, the symbolization process. There are many things which determine what you say at stage five, which is the final verbal output. The final draft. Now, one of the things, obviously, that will determine what comes out at number five is the language available to you, the symbols available to you. If you do not have the symbol system of the oil painter, you're not likely to end up with a very effective oil painting. If you don't have the symbols available to a person who plays the piano, you're not likely to end up with an output that will be in the form of a very effective music of that form. If you can't talk French, you won't have any verbal output that will be French, and so on. Now, the most important kind of observation like this to make, I think, has to do with the what might be called the vocabulary deficiency, which consists of two things. One is, there are two kinds of vocabulary deficiency. One is the lack of whole blocks of vocabulary in the language which you do know how to speak. That is, if, for instance, you speak English or Japanese or French or whatever, within that language there are many, many languages. People who speak English speak a thousand tongues, of course, so to speak. Now, if you can't speak chemistry at all, chemistry is a language, whatever else it may be. What you learn when you take a course in chemistry is a language called chemistry. Now, if you can't speak chemistry at all, well, there's that much, then, of symbolization that you can't perform. And so, no matter what you observe at stage one, no matter what there is there to be observed, at stage five, you're not going to be able to report to yourself or to others anything about it, as you would be able to filter it, that you would be able to report in the language called chemistry. Well, now, using that as an example, you can think of many more examples. There are people, if one may judge from the Gallup poll every now and then, who are apparently without the language called geography. One of the most interesting vocabulary deficiencies of this kind that I'm aware of is to be found in the fact, let me ask for a show of hands. You all have now got into college quite a ways. How many of you have had a course that was concerned with human physiology? I don't mean now your animal bi. I don't mean that at all. Human physiology. You ought to look around. It's too bad you're looking at the backs of heads. You up here, there are not very many hands going up. Isn't this a curious thing? How do you account for it? Why don't we teach children, young people in elementary and high school, college, quite a lot about their own bodies, at least one three-semester hour course devoted to that, not the body of the salamander or the fishworm or the cat, but you, your body? Why not? How do you account for that? Why is this not done? All over the United States, all over the world, there are committees. Some of them are probably meeting at this hour. They're made up of persons dedicated to the cause of education, and they are deciding what everybody should know. What courses should we teach? What should the curriculum be? This has been going on for years and years. A great deal of time has been devoted to it. And evidently, out of all of these deliberations have come the decisions not to teach about the body very much. How do you account for those decisions? What is your theory? Is it that after due consideration, any reasonable person would conclude that the body is not important? Would you conclude that? Or do you conclude, as a practical educational administrator, that it would be that there isn't enough known about the body to make a course? Or would you conclude that it would be too hard to teach? Well, if you don't conclude any of these things, what do you conclude? How do you account for the fact that this isn't done? This is one of the greatest language deficiencies that you find, the lack of the ability to talk physiology. Physiology is a language. It's a language about you. Undoubtedly, I say undoubtedly, that's the noise I make, this has something to do with the nutritional problems we have, with the health problems of people generally. It probably has something to do that you keep with the fact that you keep on smoking in spite of everything that you read about the relationship between cancer of the lung and smoking. I think if you could talk physiology very fluently, you might be a little more likely to tell yourself some things that you can't now. You don't have the language. You couldn't possibly symbolize what you would need to in order to be affected. Some people apparently can do this. I was talking the other day to one of the men in the Department of Internal Medicine over here at University Hospital. There were 12 of them, I believe, major staff members. And we were chatting, and it turned out that all but two had stopped smoking cigarettes in the last year or two. And the two who were continuing to smoke, they'd all stopped smoking cigarettes. There were still two who were smoking pipes. I think it makes a difference what languages you know. And I think that, now I have a theory. I know it's not important. You want to hear it? As to why it is... why it is we don't teach physiology any more than we do, and we don't teach it much, that's for sure. I think the only theory I've been able to come up with, and I have thought about this a lot, I have read, I've had lots of conversations with people who ought to be informed. The only thing I can come up with is that this goes back to the folk thinking, the folk language, about which equates the flesh and sin. And in our zeal to get away from sin, we turn away from the flesh to the degree that we don't teach children about it in the form of their own bodies. The body is somehow bad. Many things about the body that are related to sin and suffering, and so we just pretend it isn't there. Well, that's my theory. You got one? It's just a theory. On this level. Don't pay any more attention to it than you have a mind to. Now, other things, there's another kind of vocabulary deficiency besides these I'm talking about, lack of whole blocks. I think one of the, there are two that you get very, very sensitive to in the field I work in. One is the language of mathematics, statistics, probability, statistics. You see, our students are supposed to take courses in statistics. And this, the difficulty they have with this is more than just ordinary. There is some kind of a profound resistance here that is motivated in more than an ordinary way. And I think it must be related to the folk language. The language of probability is so utterly different from the categorical language of the folk that it's just very difficult to learn to use it. At least it's very difficult in one semester to do that. Another one is the language that we call psychology. Almost everybody that I know as a student in our own program has had psychology, as we say. And it is amazing to observe how little this language has apparently stayed with them. It's like, it's almost the same kind of observation you make about the fact that they have had German. They had a year of German, but they never speak it. They had a year of psychology, but they never speak it. And I think the reason is that it is so much at variance with the folk language. There's almost nothing in the folk language about things like learning and motivation. And the whole idea that you can be experimental about people and about behavior is simply foreign to the kind of thinking and the language which we're used to using to talk about ourselves. And so it just doesn't take. It is a language that is foreign. It's as foreign as French. Another kind of vocabulary deficiency which operates at that stage affects the symbolization process, determines what we say at five, is the rigidity or the limited meanings that are attached, if we can use this language, to the words that are known. This is something that I could talk about the rest of the winter. But let me just say this much. There is, if you get at all interested in the field that we call linguistics, you'll find that there are two major points of view among the linguists. There are what might be called the classical linguists who are very much concerned with, I'm going to write a word up here, with what they regard as norms or standards. Correctness is one of the